You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled From Jesus to Christ, given in 1911. This is Lecture 2. In the preceding lecture, I tried to give you an idea of an initiation of a kind which ought not to exist according to our valuation of human nature. This initiation, as we have seen it in Jesuitism, consists in the acquisition of certain occult faculties, which, when examined in the light of purified and cleansed occult thought, we cannot consider good. It will now be my task to show that the Rosicrucian way is characterized by all that respect for human nature which we ourselves feel. For this purpose we must be clear upon certain points. From explanations, which up to the present day have been given under different forms, we know that the Rosicrucian initiation is essentially a development of the Christian initiation, so that we can speak of it as a Christian Rosicrucian initiation. In earlier courses of lectures, the purely Christian initiation, with its 7 degrees, and the Rosicrucian initiation, also with its 7 degrees, have been compared. But now we must specially note that in regard to initiation, the principle of the development of the human soul must be absolutely preserved. We know that the Rosicrucian initiation had its proper beginning somewhere about the 13th century. At that time it was recognized by those individualities who have to guide the deeper destinies of human evolution as the right initiation for the more advanced human souls. From this fact, it is evident that the initiation of the Rose Cross took specially into account the continuous progress of the human soul. Consequently, it had to take the further development of the human soul since the 13th century also into account. The souls, therefore, which today are to be led to initiation, can no longer adopt the standpoint of the 13th century. I want especially to point this out, because in our time there is such a strong desire to label everything with some mark or other, with some catchword. From this bad habit, not from any justified cause, the theosophical movement has been labeled in such a way as might gradually lead to calamity. It is true that within our movement that which is called the principle of Rosicrucianism can be fully found. Within our theosophical movement, we can penetrate into the sources of Rosicrucianism. It is justifiable, on the one side, that persons who, by means of our present theosophical training, penetrate into the sources of Rosicrucianism, should call themselves Rosicrucians. But it must be emphasized as strongly, on the other side, that outsiders have no right to call the theosophical stream which we represent the Rosicrucian stream. For, in that case, whether consciously or unconsciously, our movement is designated by a wholly wrong name. We are no longer standing at the point at which the Rosicrucians stand in the 13th century and onward through the following centuries, but we take into account the progress of the human soul. Consequently, what is pointed out in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, as the way best adapted for entrance into the higher worlds, must not, without further explanation, be confused with what may be called the Rosicrucian way. Through our stream, we may penetrate into true Rosicrucianism, but the sphere of our spiritual movement, which comprises a far wider domain than that of the Rosicrucians, vis-à-vis the whole of theosophy, should not be designated as Rosicrucian. Our movement must simply be described as the theosophy of today, as the 20th century theosophy. Outsiders especially place themselves more or less unconsciously under some misunderstanding if they designate our movement simply as Rosicrucianism. It must, however, be characteristic of us as a preeminently Rosicrucian achievement since the dawn of modern occult spiritual life in the 13th century, that all present-day initiation is bound to recognize and treasure, in the deepest sense of the word, as something independent within the innermost recesses of the human being, that which we designate as man's holy of holies, his will center. This obligation was shown in the last lecture. And because through the occult methods characterized in that lecture, the will of the person is overcome, enslaved, and directed along a predetermined path, on this account, true occultism must studiously avoid that path. Before we enter upon a description of Rosicrucianism and upon a characterization of present-day initiation, we shall mention a fact which is decisive, vis-à-vis that the Rosicrucian initiation of 13th, 14th, and 15th, and even of the 16th and 17th centuries, has again had to be modified in our time. The Rosicrucianism of preceding centuries could not reckon with a spiritual element which since then has entered into human evolution. Without this element today, we cannot any longer understand rightly the beginning of all those spiritual streams which rise from the ground of occultism, or indeed of any theosophical stream. For reasons which we shall see more exactly in the course of these lectures, the teaching of reincarnation and karma, of repeated earth lives, which today must stand as the very starting point of theosophic knowledge, could not, through many centuries, be included in the external, the exoteric teachings of Christianity. In the 13th century, the teaching of reincarnation and karma had not yet entered, in the highest sense, into the first stages of Rosicrucian initiation. One might attain as far as the fourth or fifth degree of Rosicrucianism. One could go through what is called in Rosicrucian initiation the Rosicrucian studium, the acquiring of imagination, the acquiring of the occult writing, the finding of the philosopher's stone, and could also experience something of what is called the mystic death. One could come as far as this stage and acquire exceptionally high occult knowledge, and yet not necessarily have attained to full clearness concerning the illuminating teachings of reincarnation and karma. We must clearly understand that as today, owing to the progress of mankind in thinking, thought forms have entered into this thinking, through which, if we only think logically, matters can now easily be thought out exoterically. We can come unconditionally to the recognition of repeated earth lives, and therewith to the recognition of the idea of karma. The words spoken by Strader in my second Rosicrucian drama, The Soul's Probation, vis-à-vis that the logical thinker of today, if he does not want to break with all that the thought forms of the last century have brought, must come finally to the recognition of karma and reincarnation, are absolutely true of present-day spiritual life. Just because this knowledge is something that has slowly been prepared and is rooted in the depth of our spiritual life, it appears naturally little by little in Western intellectual life. It is remarkable how many eminent thinkers, pursuing independent lines of thought, have felt the necessity of recognizing repeated earth lives. We need only call attention to many things which either intentionally or unintentionally are quite forgotten in our present-day literature. Take, for example, what we meet in so wonderful a way in Lessing's title Education of the Human Race. We see how Lessing, that great spirit of the 18th century, who at the zenith of his life gathered up the sum of his thoughts and wrote the Education of the Human Race, came as by inspiration to the thought of repeated earth lives. The idea of reincarnation comes into modern life as by inner necessity, and must be taken into consideration. Certainly it must be considered differently from an idea in natural history or in modern cultural life. In such a case, refuge is taken in the familiar saying that with old people, though in earlier life they may have been keen thinkers, there is always some allowance to be made. And even as regards Lessing, though we may appreciate him in his earlier works, we must allow that in later years, when he came to the idea of repeated earth lives, he had become somewhat feeble. In more recent times, also the idea of reincarnation occurs sporadically. Drosbach, a psychologist of the 19th century, has spoken of it as was only possible in the last century. Without occultism, simply through observation of what nature offers, Drosbach tried in his own way as psychologist to establish the idea of repeated earth lives. Further, in the middle of last century, a small society offered a prize for the best essay on the immortality of the soul. The prize essay of Wiedemann endeavored, in accordance with the idea of repeated earth lives, to prove the immortality of the soul. Imperfectly, to be sure, as needs must be in the 50s of the last century, when the thought forms were not yet so far developed. We might quote many references in which this idea of repeated earth lives springs up as a postulate, as a demand of the 19th century. Consequently, in my little book titled Reincarnation and Karma, and also in my book titled Theosophy, the idea of repeated earth lives and of karma could be further developed in connection with the thought forms of natural science. In my books, these thought forms are worked out with reference to human individuality in contrast with the animal species. We must, however, be clear that there is an immense difference between the way in which, in the West, men simply, through thought, have come to this idea, and the way in which it is presented in Buddhism. It is most interesting to cast a glance at the way in which Lessing, in his title Education of the Human Race, came upon the conception of reincarnation. Of course, we are not comparing ideas only. We are also contrasting in European thought and in Buddhism the way in which those ideas are reached. The way in which Lessing came upon the idea of reincarnation is by no means generally recognized. How did he come upon it? We can see quite clearly how he came upon it when we study the education of the human race. It is undeniable that in the evolution of humanity, progress in the strictest sense of the word can be observed. Lessing expresses himself as follows. This progress is an education of humanity by the divine powers. He says further, God gave into man's hand a first elementary book, the Old Testament. Thereby a certain stage of human evolution was established. When the human race was further advanced, there came the second elementary book, the New Testament. And then Lessing sees in our time something that goes beyond the New Testament, an independent feeling of the human soul for the true, the good, and the beautiful. This is for him a third stage in the education of the human race. The thought of the education of the human race by the divine powers is worked out in a lofty style. The question arises in Lessing's mind, what is the one and only explanation of this progress? He cannot explain it otherwise than by allowing each soul to take a part in each epoch of human civilization. That is, if progress in human evolution is to have any meaning at all. For there would be no meaning in it if one soul lived only in the epoch of Old Testament civilization and another soul only in the New Testament epoch. There is only meaning in it if souls are taken through all epochs of civilization and share in all stages of human education. In other words, if the soul lives through repeated earth lives, the progressive education of the human race has the right significance. Thus the idea of repeated earth lives springs up in Lessing's mind as one that is destined for man. For in a deeper sense, the following lies at the base of Lessing's idea. If a soul was incarnated at the time of the Old Testament, it took into itself that of which it was then capable. And when it reappears later on, it brings over the fruits of that preceding life into the next. the fruits of the second life again into the following, and so on. Thus, the successive stages in evolution are interdependent, and what a soul has acquired for itself, it has not merely for itself, but for the whole of humanity. Humanity is a great organism, and for Lessing, reincarnation becomes necessary, so that the whole of the human race can push forward. It is historical evolution, the concern of the whole of humanity, which Lessing takes as his starting point. From this starting point, he is impelled to the recognition of reincarnation. It is otherwise if we trace out the same idea in Buddhism. There, the person is concerned merely with himself, with his own soul. There, the individual soul says to itself, quote, I am placed in the world of Maya. Desire brought me into the world of Maya. And in the course of repeated incarnations, I free myself as an individual soul from the necessity of earthly incarnations. This is a concern of the single individual. Here the gaze is centered on the single individual. That is the great difference in the paths. Whether a person looks on the question from within, as in Buddhism, or from without, as does Lessing, whose gaze takes in the whole of human evolution. In both cases, the same idea makes its appearance, but the path is quite another in the West. While the Buddhist limits himself to a concern of the individual soul, the gaze of the man of the West is directed to the concern of the whole of humanity. The man of the West feels himself bound up with all men, as within a single organism. What is it, then, that has taught the man of the West the necessity of thinking not simply of the individual, but of having continually before his mind, as the most important matter, that he has to do with the concern of collective humanity? This necessity has arisen within him, through the fact that into the sphere of the heart, into his world of feeling, he has received the words of Christ Jesus concerning human brotherhood, that it is beyond all nationality, beyond all race characteristics, and that humanity is a great organism. Consequently, it is interesting to see how, in the case of Drossbach, of whom I spoke, his thinking, although it is certainly still imperfect, because the scientific ideas of the first half of the 19th century had not yet produced the corresponding thought forms, does not take the Buddhistic path, but a universal cosmic one. Drossbach begins from the thoughts of natural science and observes the soul in its cosmic aspect. He cannot think otherwise of the soul than as the seed, which goes through an external form and reappears in other external forms. That is to say, it is reincarnated. This thought arises in fantasy in the case of Drossbach, for he thinks that the world itself must be transformed, whereas Lessing certainly, justifiably, thought of short periods of time. Quite logically, too, does Wiedemann, in his prize essay, think of the immortality of the soul in reference to the question of reincarnation. We see, therefore, that all these ideas appear sporadically, and it is right that in spite of faulty modes of thinking, they should spring up not only in minds such as these, but in others also. The great change in evolution, which the human soul has undergone from the 18th to the 20th century, is such that everyone today who begins the study of world progress must needs, before all else, make those thought forms his own, which lead quite naturally to the reception, to the making credible of the ideas of reincarnation and karma. Between the 13th and 18th centuries, human thought was not sufficiently advanced to come by itself to the recognition of reincarnation. We have always to begin from the ground on which human thought, at the period in question, stands in its most developed form. Today the starting point must be that form of thinking which, on the basis of natural science, regards the idea of repeated earth lives as logically or hypothetically tenable. Thus do the ages progress. without specially describing the Rosicrucian path in the present lecture, we will consider what is really essential to both the Rosicrucian method and the method of initiation knowledge of the present time. The characteristic of both is that everyone who gives advice and guidance for initiation values in the deepest sense the independence and the inviolability of the sphere of the human will. Hence the essential point is that through a quite special kind of moral culture, through a special kind of mental culture, the ordinary interweaving of the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and ego must be made other than it is by nature. And those directions which are given for the training of the moral feelings, as also the directions given for concentration in thinking, for meditation, all make finally for the one goal of loosening the spiritual structure in which the physical body and etheric body of man are connected, so that the etheric body does not remain so firmly fitted into the physical body as is naturally the case. All exercises strive after this lifting out, this loosening of the etheric body. Thereby, another union between the astral body and the etheric body is brought about. It is through the fact that in our ordinary life, the etheric body and the physical body are in a high degree firmly united, that in ordinary daily life our astral body cannot feel anything, cannot experience anything of what is going on in the etheric body. Through the fact that the etheric body has its seat within the physical body, our astral body and our ego, by means of the physical body, perceive only that which the physical body allows to come to them from the world through the instrument of the brain. The etheric body is too deeply embedded in the physical body for it to be experienced by man in ordinary life as an independent entity, as an independent instrument of cognition, and also as an instrument of feeling and willing. The efforts in concentrated thinking, according to instructions given today, and as they were given also by the Rosicrucians, the efforts in meditation, the cleansing of the moral feelings, all these finally produce the effect on the etheric body, which is described in my volume titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. As we use our eyes for seeing, and our hands for grasping, so eventually we shall use the etheric with its organs, not, however, for looking into the physical world, but into the spiritual world. The way in which we gather together our inner life and concentrate in it works for the independence of the etheric body. But we must previously, at least tentatively, permeate ourselves with the idea of karma. And we permeate ourselves with the idea of karma when we establish an equilibrium as regards morality, an equilibrium of the psychic forces of feeling. A person who cannot, to a certain extent, grasp the thought that, quote, in the long run I myself am to blame for my impulses, close quote, will not be able to make good progress. A certain equanimity and understanding, even if only a purely hypothetical understanding with regard to karma, is necessary as a starting point. A person who, quote, never gets away, close quote, from his ego, who is so dependent upon his narrowly limited ways of feeling and perception, that when things do not succeed with him, he attaches the blame always to others and never to himself. A person who is always filled with the idea that the world or a part of his environment is against him, who, to put it simply, is to a certain extent an embittered hypochondriac, a man who does not get beyond that which he may attain when he grasps with ordinary thinking what can be learned from exoteric theosophy, such a person will find progress specially difficult. Hence it is well that in order to develop equanimity and calmness of soul, we should make ourselves familiar with the idea that when something does not succeed, particularly on the occult path, we must blame not others, but ourselves. That best helps forward our progress. What helps least is when we want always to lay the blame on the world outside, when we are always wanting to change its methods. Our attitude in such matters is much more important than perhaps appears. It is better continually to test carefully how little we have learned, and to seek the fault in ourselves when progress is not made. It is really a quite significant advance when we can make up our minds always to seek the fault in ourselves. Then we shall see that we make progress not only in things which lie beyond, but also in matters of external life. Those who have some experience of these things will at all times be able to testify that through the thought that the blame for non-success is to be laid upon oneself, they find something that makes even their external life easy and bearable. We shall get on much more easily with our environment when we can truly grasp this fact. We shall rise above much grumbling and hypochondria, above complaining and lamenting, and pursue our way more calmly. For we should reflect that in every true modern initiation, he who gives advice is under the strictest obligation not to penetrate into the inner sanctuary of the soul. From the first, in regard to the innermost part of the soul, we have ourselves to undertake something, and may not complain that perhaps we do not get the right advice. The advice may be right, and yet the results may not be satisfactory if we do not make the resolve indicated. This equanimity, this calmness, when we have once chosen, and the choosing ought to take place only as the result of a serious resolve, is a good ground on which meditation, by surrendering oneself to thoughts and feelings, can be built up. In all that stands on the foundation of Rosicrucianism, in all meditation and concentration, it is significant that we are directed not to dogma, but to what is universally human. By a bypath characterized in the preceding lecture, the start was made from that which had previously been given to man as personal mental content. But how would it have been if this personal content had had first to be proved through occult knowledge? What if such content were in no way firmly established beforehand? We must accept the basis upon which Rosicrucian principles stand, namely, that we are not in a position to decide upon anything which is only supported by external material documents, for example, the accounts of what took place as the event of Golgotha. We must learn to know these things first by the occult path. We may not assume them beforehand. On this account, the beginning should be made from the universally human, from that which can be justified by every soul. A glance into the great world, marveling at the revelation of light in the sun, S-U-N, feeling that what our eyes see of light is only the external veil of the light, its external revelation, or, as is said in Christian esotericism, the glory of the light, and then yielding oneself up to the thought that behind the external sensible light something quite different is hidden. All this is something fundamentally human. To think of, to gaze on the light spread out through infinite space, and then clearly to feel that in this infinitely extended element of the light something spiritual must live, something which weaves this web of light in space. To concentrate upon these thoughts, to live in them. Here we have something universally human, presented not through a dogma but through universal feeling. Or again, to perceive the warmth of nature, to feel how, through the universe, along with the warmth, something moves, in which there is spirit. Then, out of certain relationships in our own organism, with the experiences of the feelings of love, to concentrate upon the thought how warmth can exist spiritually, how it lives pulsing through the world. Then to sink oneself into that which we can learn from intuitions given to us by modern occult teaching. Then to take counsel with those who know something in this sphere of thought regarding concentration in the right way upon thoughts which are world thoughts, cosmic thoughts. Then, further, the ennobling, the cleansing of the moral perceptions, whereby we attain to the understanding that that which we feel to be moral is reality, and whereby we rise above the prejudice that our moral perceptions are something transitory. Thus it is clear that what we now feel lives on, is stamped into us as a moral entity. We learn to feel the responsibility of being placed as a conscious being in the world with that which is our moral feeling. All esoteric life is really directed to that which is common to humanity. I shall now describe how far we can attain if we give ourselves up to exercises which begin from our human nature, if we only surrender ourselves to a wise self-examination of our human nature. Starting from this point, we attain to the loosening of the connection between the physical body and the etheric body, and to a new kind of knowledge. We give birth, as it were, to a second man within ourselves, so that we are no longer so firmly connected with the physical body as before. And in the supreme moments of life, we feel the etheric and astral bodies embedded, as it were, in an external sheath, and thereby know ourselves to be free from the instrument of the physical body. This it is which we attain. We shall certainly be led to see our physical body in its true being, and to recognize how it affects us when we are within it. We shall only become aware of the whole working of the physical body upon us when we have in a certain sense come out of it, like the snake which, when it has cast its skin, can look upon the skin from outside, though feeling it a part of itself. To the first stages of initiation we learn, in like manner, to feel ourselves free from the physical body and learn to recognize it. In this moment, quite special feelings steal over us, which may be described as follows. There are so many different experiences along the path of initiation that as yet it has not been possible to describe them all. In Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, you find much on the subject, but there is much more than is contained in that volume. The first experience, one known to nearly every one of us who in ordinary life pursues the path of knowledge, is such that speaking in accordance with our feeling, we say, quote, "This physical body as it is, as it appears to me, has not been formed by myself. It is certain that I have not made this physical body through which I have been brought to what I am in the world. If I had not this body, the ego, which I now regard as my great ideal, would not have arisen within me. I have become what I am only through having kept my physical body riveted upon me." There arises, first of all, something like resentment against the cosmic powers that, quote, "I have become what I am." It is easy to say, quote, "I will not cherish this resentment." When there arises before us in melancholy majesty that which we have become through the way in which we are bound up with our physical body, its power is overwhelming. We feel something like resentment or bitter hatred against the cosmic powers that we are what we are. But now our occult training must be so far advanced that we overcome this hatred, and on a higher stage can say with our whole being, with our individuality which has already come down in two incarnations, it is we who are responsible for what our physical body has become. When we overcome this bitterness, there arises the feeling, already often described, quote, "Now I know that I am that very thing which appears there as the transformed figure of my physical being, that I am myself. But because it was crushing me to death, I knew nothing of my physical being." We stand here before the significant meeting with the guardian of the threshold. But if we come so far, if through the strenuousness of our exercises we experience what has just been said, then from out of what is common to human nature, we recognize that what we are in our present form is the result of preceding incarnations. But we also recognize that we have to experience the deepest pain and must work ourselves out beyond this pain to the conquest of our present existence. And for every man who is sufficiently far advanced and has experienced these feelings in all their intensity, who has looked upon the guardian of the threshold, there arises of necessity an imaginative picture, a picture which is not painted by constraint, as in Jesuitism, from that which stands in the Bible, but which each man experiences through that which he has felt in common with all mankind, that which he is. Through these very experiences, he would quite naturally come to know the picture of the divine ideal man, who, like us, lived in a physical body, and who, like us, in this physical body felt all that can be done by a physical body. The temptations, the picture of the temptation that is presented to us in the Synoptic Gospels, the leading of Christ Jesus to the mountain, the promise of all external realities, the desire to cling to the outer realities, the temptation to remain attached to matter, in short, the temptation to remain with the guardian of the threshold and not to pass beyond him, appears to us in the great imaginative picture which would have presented itself even if we had never heard of the Gospels. That is, Christ Jesus standing on the mountain and the tempter beside him. And then we know that he who wrote the story of the temptation has depicted his own experience as he saw in the Spirit Christ Jesus and the tempter. Then we know that it is true. In the Spirit it is true that the writer of the Gospel has described something that we ourselves can experience, even though we know nothing of the Gospels. Thus we shall be led to a picture which is similar to the picture in the Gospels. We gain for ourselves what stands in the Gospels. Nothing is constrained, everything is drawn forth from the depths of our own nature. We proceed from what is common to humanity, and bring forth the Gospels afresh through our occult life. We feel ourselves one with the writers of the Gospels. Then there arises within us another feeling, a next step in the occult path. We feel how the tempter who appeared there has grown into a mighty being who is behind all the phenomena of the world. Yes, we learn indeed to know the tempter, but we learn by degrees, in a certain way, to value him. We learn to say, quote, "The world which spreads itself out before us, be it Maya or something else, has its right to exist. It has revealed something to us." Close quote. Then there comes a second feeling, which again can be described as a quite concrete one. In the case of every person who fulfills the conditions of a Rosicrucian initiation, the feeling arises, quote, "We belong to the Spirit who lives in all things, and with whom we have to reckon. We cannot in the least comprehend the Spirit if we do not surrender ourselves to it." Close quote. Then fear comes over us. We experience fear such as every real knower must go through, a feeling for the greatness of the cosmic Spirit which pervades the world. We are in the presence of this greatness, and we feel our own powerlessness. We feel also what we might have become in the course of the earth's progress, or indeed in that of the cosmos. We feel our own impotent existence, which is so far removed from divine existence. We feel fear in the face of the ideal which we must come to resemble, and before the greatness of the effort which is to lead us to that ideal. As through esotericism we must feel the whole greatness of the effort, so must we feel this fear as a struggle which we take upon ourselves, a struggle with the Spirit of the cosmos. When we feel this, our own littleness, the necessity laid upon us to struggle in order to attain our ideal, to become one with that which works and weaves in the world, when we experience it with fear, then only may we lay this fear aside and betake ourselves to the path, to the paths which lead us to our ideal. But because we feel this so fully and rightly, there comes before us yet another significant imagination. If we had never read a gospel, if mankind had never had such an external book, a spiritual picture would rise before our clairvoyant sight. We are led out into the solitude, which stands clearly before the inner eye, EYE, and we are brought before the picture of the ideal man, who, in a human body, experienced all the anguish, the terrors in their infinite greatness, which we ourselves can taste in this moment. The picture of Christ in Gethsemane stands before us as he experienced fear in an overwhelmingly intensified degree, the fear that we ourselves must feel on the path of initiation, the fear that wrung from his brow the bloody sweat. This picture we have at a certain point of our occult path, without external documents. Like two mighty pillars, there stand before us upon the occult path the story of the temptation experienced spiritually, and the scene on the Mount of Olives experienced spiritually. And then we understand the words, "Watch and pray, and live in prayer, so that ye may never be tempted to remain standing on any one point, but that ye may continually stride forward." This means experiencing the Gospels first. It means that we experience everything so that we could write it down just as the writers of the Gospels have described it. For we do not need to take the two pictures just described out of the Gospel. We can take them out of our own inner consciousness. We can bring them forth out of the Holy of Holies of the soul. No teacher is needed to come and say, quote, "You must place before yourselves in imagination the temptation, the scene on the Mount of Olives," close quote. We need only to place before ourselves that which in our consciousness can be developed in meditation as purification of our common human feelings. Then, without constraint from anyone, we can call forth the imaginations which are contained in the Gospel. The Jesuit spiritual movement described in the preceding lecture was such that the pupil had the Gospels given to him first and afterward experienced what was set forth in the Gospels. The path described in the present lecture shows that when a man has betaken himself to the path of the spiritual life, he first occultly experiences that which is connected with his own life, and thereby can experience through himself the pictures, the imaginations of the Gospels. The end of Lecture 2.